This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, East Africa's continued turmoil and how best the U.S. Africa Command can both assist government forces in that region as well as respond directly to armed threats, and how a drawdown in U.S. forces in parts of East Africa will affect stability operations. Hello, I'm Jeffrey Young, sitting in for Carol Castiel. With us to discuss East Africa's insurgencies, their ideologies, and the forces behind them are, joining Encounter remotely, Colin Clark in Pittsburgh and Xavier Ichani in Nairobi, Kenya, as we continue to practice social distancing in Washington. Mr. Clark is with the Soufan Center in New York City, and Dr. Ichani is with Kenyatta University in Nairobi. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
East Africa for years has had Muslim extremism, Al-Shabaab primarily in Somalia and various other elements of Al-Qaeda, along with recent attacks, including one at the Africa Hotel in Mogadishu and the unsuccessful targeting of Somali's president and prime minister in another city. Fighting in the town of Bulawahara has sent people fleeing from there and also from the nearby Kenyan border town of Mandera. Meanwhile, the previous U.S. presidential administration began a drawdown of the 700 U.S. troops stationed in Somalia. In light of the ongoing situation in Somalia, what is the best way forward both for Somali forces and for U.S. Africa Command, which was there to train elite Somali counterterrorism units? What's your perspective, Dr. Ichani?
Before I really answer that question, I want us a little bit to go back and see the mandate and perhaps the issues revolving about the American intervention in the East Africa. You'll note that the U.S. AFRICOM has the mandate that runs through intelligence gathering, also recognizes issues, as well occasionally falling into kinetic action where it's involved in direct hostilities with this. Although the mandate is very clear, that is basically about training and professionalizing the security organs in Eastern Africa and the rest of Africa, you need to note that Africa is a continent of both hope and despair. In that hope, it is building and it has enormous economic resources, but as well as its despair because it is home to insurgency and rise of terrorism in the recent past. And most of the armies within or the security organs within East Africa have evolved from what sometimes I call rudimentary forces. Some of these have been in a war-torn country. When you're speaking about Somalia, it has been having no government, total failure or a failed state for over 25 years. And therefore, if the United States, for instance, the AFRICOM, will not obviously be engaged in kinetic action against the possibility or the capability of the Somali forces to contain, the issues of terrorism will not be achieved in reality. So basically, there are two ways in which the United States Africa Command can act on this. The first one is to provide intelligence as is intended in the mandate, but occasionally it has to intervene directly so as to control the spread of this. We are also aware that insurgencies can only not be fought through the military action. It's beyond that. The military is maybe sufficient, but not maybe necessary, yes, but not sufficient enough to address the issues of insurgencies and terrorism. And therefore, there is need to explore both the carrot and stick measures when we come to dealing with issues of insurgencies.
Dr. Clark, what do you think of what Dr. Ichani has just said? What about his positions?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's right on a number of points. First, that any kind of U.S. assistance needs to be intelligence driven, which is going to be more difficult with forces not actually on the ground in Somalia. But that one of the truisms of counterinsurgency, and we've known this for a long time, is that it can't be a purely kinetic campaign. There's got to be a more comprehensive approach looking at what some of the major issues are plaguing Somalia, including governance, including the strength of the judiciary and institutions, And so there's a number of issues to look at. And this isn't something new. We've been analyzing these kind of same collection of factors and variables for several decades now, looking at the ongoing instability and overlapping conflicts in the Horn of Africa.
While I have your attention right now, you are one of the experts in terrorist financing and revenue streams. Al-Shabaab has been going on and on and on for years in the Horn of Africa. How are they supporting themselves? What is the revenue stream? Are they doing taxation like the Islamic State was doing in the areas in Syria that it conquered, etc.? Give us an idea as to the revenue flows that support Al-Shabaab and other insurgents in East Africa. Where are they getting their money?
Well, it's ebbed and flowed over time. There's been various points when they've focused on the sugar trade. There's been connections to charcoal. We do know that extortion and taxation are a major funding stream as well. And while it's important to focus on the credits, all the money that the groups bring in, it's also important to focus on debits. This is a group that doesn't necessarily have high debits. They're not paying for a whole lot. And so the money that they bring in lasts for a long time and is able to facilitate, you know, some of the operations we've seen that this group is capable of conducting. And still, it remains capable of conducting what we call spectacular attacks, not only in Mogadishu, but in the surrounding areas, and as well outside of Somalia, as it's proven in the past.
Dr. Ajani, I want to bring this back to you now. Again, Al-Shabaab and other bad actors have been in the region now for years. What is their base of support? Do people really want an Islamic caliphate in the Horn of Africa? Is this just a goal of groups like Al-Shabaab to impose their power and their governance on other people? Where's the support base for this? How do these insurgents keep going?
To respond to your question, we need to note that groups that use force, or rather terrorists as discussed here, do not operate in a vacuum. Some of these groups have a wider following, a constituency of its own. They have sympathizers across the countries. And in the case of Somalia, we have factions in terms of clans that have supported the idea of Sharia law. And therefore, Al-Shabaab is appealing to them. Note that they interpret any intervention as external, as occupation in their land. And therefore, when they do that, they are able to elicit the support of their constituents. And they join hands, they contribute funds, as Dr. Clark has said, to support the organizations. And one very critical issue we're about to note about this Al-Shabaab, right from the beginning of when the government of Siad Barre was overthrown, we had it come as what we talked of as Islamic Union. And this later on transformed to what we call Islamic Court Union. Upon the Ethiopian intervention in 2006, it transformed into Al-Shabaab. And as the much-talked Greek myth of the Hydra, that a reptile with two heads, where when you chop two germinate, these insurgents or terrorists in Somalia have been transforming or metamorphosing every now and then. And the current one becomes more militant adept and is capable of using any kind of action against the perceived interveners or those who are opposing it. Sometimes the issue is perceived as if it is the struggle against two civilizations. We talk of the Western civilization dominated by the Christians, and that's perhaps where the US and the African command comes from, in support with the partners like Kenya, which is also perceived to be primarily Christian. And therefore, it is a clash of two civilizations, in the words of Samuel Huntington, where now Christianity is pitched against Islam. And therefore, this brings an appeal to what we even talk of anti-racist sentiments among these particular groups that fighting within Somalia and jeopardizing security within the East African region as that.
What do you think, Dr. Clark? What's your reaction to what Dr. Ajani just said?
No, I mean, I think Dr. Attani clearly knows the history of Somalia and many of the problems plaguing the country. And I largely agree. I think analyzing this from the not looking as much as the at the insurgents, but the counterinsurgents, what does the United States need to do to be able to assist? Look, this is all part of the larger conversation that's going on in the U.S. national security establishment about does the United States continue the global war on terror, the poorly named global war on terror, or is there a more fundamental shift toward what we call great power competition, toward conflict with China, Russia, Iran, other nation states? And I argue that the United States can and should do both. This isn't, you know, an either or matter. I think the United States needs to continue countering the influence of those aforementioned countries. But still, we can't just walk away from a counterterrorism fight and allow groups like Al-Shabaab and other groups operating throughout Africa in the Sahel and other parts of sub-Saharan Africa to grow, to flourish, to network, and to potentially turn their sights on Western targets. So I think we need to keep applying pressure. We need to keep working closely with the Somalis. And unfortunately, there's a bit of a stalemate, and it requires strategic patience, but also giving AFRICOM the resources needed to continue this fight.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Joining me remotely are Dr. Colin Clark, a terrorism expert with the Soufan Center in New York, and Professor Xavier Francis Ichani at the School of Security, Diplomacy, and Peace Studies at Kenyatta University in Nairobi. We're discussing the continued turmoil in parts of East Africa and what the U.S. Africa Command can do to support government forces and help ensure stability. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a big shout out to a loyal listener from Gombe, Nigeria, Bar Inusa Mohammed. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Now back to our program on the security situation in East Africa. Another aspect of this discussion worth bringing up is the role of transnational bodies, such as the Sahel 5 in West Africa, which is five regional nations joined together to fight Al-Qaeda and other bad actors in that area. What multilateral security arrangements exist in East Africa, and how can they be best used to suppress insurgent activity? Mr. Ichani, I'll let you go first.
There are possibly one or two ways to go about this. One, we need to note that the military performs a key issues when it comes to enhancing the U.S. foreign policy on other states. And basically, that is the foundation of AFRICOM. One, the military has to work to defeat the enemy. The military has to coerce. It has also to defeat and deter, sometimes to compel the groups. But also, the use of kinetic force is very significant in reassuring the people that the military wants to protect. So what we can borrow is that there is need of good cooperation between the partners and the U.S. AFRICOM. But whereas in East Africa, we have partners like Kenya that they would join hands with the United States in the war against terror. In the Sahel region, it's a bit different. Note that the group or the we have sub-Saharan population here that shares between two different, so to speak, races are that. We have a Muslim segment of population as well as the Christian segment of population. And therefore, when it goes to where people ascribe to Islam, you'll find much resistance towards the AFRICOM operations. And therefore, as I said earlier, that there is need to marry to the use of military force as well as diplomatic measures so that we can share with the terrorists, not engaging really in a discussion or dialogue, but need to understand what are these matters that motivate groups and youths to ascribe to using force. And once we get note of this, there is need to build the capacities of these partners or the countries where insurgencies are running. And after building the capacity, then we shall be able to have a sustainable appeal. Just as Dr. Clark said, that the war against terrorism will not take a day or two. It is going to last for some ages. It's bound to be a protracted conflict, and we should be aware of that and proceed using this two-pronged approach, the military action as well as diplomatic measures that are able to bring these groups into perhaps a negotiation, such as also to scale down their activities. There are quite a number of range of actions that can be undertaken under the engagement forum, the engagement approach with groups that use force. Occasionally, they will not wish to be called terrorists. That's why I'm shifting from groups that use force and occasionally use terrorists at that kind of discussion.
I want to bring something up here. The African Union, which of course is headquartered in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, has among its stated goals to promote, quote, peace, security, and stability on the continent, unquote. Several times, the AU has deployed multinational forces to Burundi, to Sudan, to Somalia. Should the African Union ramp up its security efforts so that there is an AU military presence on board when these regional conflicts erupt? Dr. Clark, what do you think about that?
Look, I think it's an all-hands-on-deck approach. It depends on what we're looking at in the region. There's just so many different hotspots at the moment. If you look at the proliferation of groups, if you look at Al-Qaeda and ISIS competing to recruit new members, to finance their organizations, to conduct attacks, what's happening in the Sahel looks different than what's happening in the Horn, which is different than what's happening down in Mozambique. So I think there's a question of priorities, there's a question of resources, and there's a question of having countries like the United States or France, in the case of the Sahel, act as force multipliers, perhaps, for these regional organizations like the AU, like AMISOM, like others, to see what the United States or France can bring to the table that's a complement and not redundant to what these local forces are already doing on the ground.
Now let's bring up another part of the turmoil in East Africa, and that's political instability. It's not just terrorism. Sudan and South Sudan are excellent examples of this. I mean, in South Sudan, we have the endless fight between Salva Kiir and Riek Machar, and there seems to be little or no resolution. It's one guy or the other guy, and regardless of who steps out and who steps into the fight, the other one still wants to be in the conflict. Then we had the whole situation in Sudan. Bashir is gone. They're now reestablishing themselves. Speak to the political side of the instabilities in East Africa, Dr. Inshani.
What I would say perhaps is that the African Union has a well-crafted framework to deal with issues of insecurity and political upheavals. But this is more, I can say perhaps, very novel way. They are talking of the issue of silencing the guns by 2020, which was last year. They have their Africa peace and security architecture, which well works on this. But there is also lack of that political will among to support some of these issues. And you realize that everything about politics, everything about security revolves about the politics of the state and that. And therefore, there is sometimes what we can term as not very keen to restore peace. This is a place where heads of states are talking about no term limits. They're also talking about not having kinetic action against insurgency group in some places, that this is about American neocolonialism. This is about having America secure her interest in these countries. But what we need is a balance between the two. And I believe that once we have good governance running on, then things are able to go in the correct order.
Dr. Clark, and your reaction?
I think, again, at this point, it's a wholesale reassessment. We're also in the United States transitioning from one administration to another. The Trump administration and the way that it viewed security was very much through a zero-sum lens in some parts of the world. And even against advice from top policymakers, military leaders, there was this tendency to want to withdraw and to pull back from certain parts of the world. I don't think the United States should get involved in providing kind of nation building type support. Clearly, that's not something the U.S. has done a good job at. If you look at the track record of the last 20 years in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, but there are clear aspects of security cooperation and building partner capacity that the U.S. is quite good at, including logistics. There's just certain things that the U.S. military can do that, with all due respect, no other country can do. And that extends to ISR, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. So I think there are real tangible objectives that the U.S. can pursue from a regional security standpoint throughout different parts of Africa. And now with the Biden administration, there's going to be a fair chance for that to happen. There's the political will for that. And I think there's going to be more of a coherent strategy with the U.S. operating in Africa, in the Middle East, in other kind of global hotspots that we could expect to see more than just rhetoric.
There's the endless balancing back and forth between security and development. AFRICOM, USAID, in a lot of situations, development helps negate the insurgency and makes it possible once there's inclusion. And that's the point that I wanted to finish up on. If there's political and economic inclusion, there is less of a chance of insurgency. This is what I have learned directly from being in the Middle East, from being in Iraq, and being in other places like that. Let's reflect on East Africa, on the idea of political and economic inclusion. Dr. Achani, what do you think?
Absolutely right, Mr. Yang, that political inclusion, or rather addressing the grievances of these communities and groups that use force, will play a key role in terms of ending some of this violence. Remember that some groups are because of grievances that are unresolved. And in the African context, we talk of historical injustice among several states, which have not been addressed. And some of these groups are maybe motivated to undertake violence because they have been excluded politically. And there is evidence among even militia groups in the context of Kenya, where these groups have been, for us, been governed in some extent or included, but provided with their grievances solved. And they turn their operations. So it's very important that that is understood in the context of wider application to use counterterrorism attacks. Some of these groups have legitimate issues that need to be discussed within the societies. And I think I concur with you that there is need to interlace the issues of defense with the issues of development, which are very key in making even these issues of security sustainable.
Dr. Clark, and what's your finishing thought on that?
I mean, I think we all recognize that an all-inclusive kind of whole-of-government style approach, political, economic, security, is what is in order. But I just caution that that's a long-term approach. That's something that needs to be sustained over time. And again, many times in the West, in the United States, and some European partners, there's a desire for a quick fix. I mean, you have politicians running on short election cycles, and they want to be able to show tangible results. So I think we need to look at this in longer timeframes if the desire is to be more inclusive economically, which I think it should be. But we also have to be cognizant that oftentimes those providing assistance are seeking kind of the silver bullet. And that's just not something that is likely attainable in certain parts of the world, including, I think, in East Africa.
Good point. And on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time that we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Colin P. Clark, with the Soufan Center in New York, and Dr. Xavier Francis Ichani from Kenyatta University School of Security, Diplomacy, and Peace Studies in Nairobi, He currently has been joining us from Juba. VOA thanks you both for your time and valuable insights into this very intractable and difficult and seemingly endless situation in East Africa. VOA Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm VOA's Jeffrey Young, sitting in for Carol Castillo. Join us again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.